Hello and welcome to the CEO interview. My name is Jean-François Manzoni. I'm the president of the International Institute for Management Development, better known as IMD. I have been studying, teaching, and consulting for leaders for the better part of the last three decades. One of the benefits of my job is that I get to meet and discuss with some of the world's most interesting and successful business leaders. In this podcast series, you are going to have a chance to meet them too and to hear some of their insights and advice. In every episode, I will be speaking with a different CEO. We will talk about their business, their career, their successes and their challenges, and some of the lessons they have learned so far. We will hear what makes them tick, how they define success, and we will try to understand what got them to where they are and what is keeping them there. In today's episode, I am delighted to introduce you to a very successful and inspiring entrepreneur, Mr. Jordi Kool. Jordi, you're Dutch. You've spent almost 30 years building and developing several companies in many industries, but particularly IT and tech companies. In particular, there was this company called Infotech that you took from a modest 65 million and built it into a 1 billion euro sales company. Now, I know you're no longer involved in day-to-day. Mainly your activities these days are as a board member, often as a chairman of the board, as well as an investor and as an advisor. You run your own investment group called Iron Asset Management, and you're also very active in the not-for-profit sector. Among many activities, you're on the board of a major hospital group with more than 4,000 healthcare professionals, and you're also the founder and the chairman of a charity called IT for Kids. A very successful and busy life, and I have a number of questions for you again. Thank you for making the time to be with us.
Thank you, Jean-François.
So you've had many successes over the years. If we were to pick one that really stands out among this list of success, it would be, I think, Infotech. You grew the company remarkably. Again, I said from 65 million to a billion over about 10 years. Two quick questions. One, why were you so successful? What were some of the key elements of the secret sauce? And two, how did the exit come about and how did you manage changing your relationship with the company?
Yeah, good questions. First of all, when I came in, I saw the huge potential of that company. And then the challenge is obviously to convince your fellow partners in the business. And I really think that I picked my battles over time. One of the important things we did was we innovated the business. We really transformed the business. We were in some way the front runners in the refurbishing of IT equipment, sometimes too soon, and sometimes maybe even too late. The important things of building this business was, amongst others, internationalizing the business. Funding was really important, figuring out how to fund it, how to get banks involved, or in another company I run, getting mezzanine funds on board, which I think sometimes can help you excel the business, take some risks, calculated risks, obviously. And it was very important is to surround yourself with the right group of people. Without the people, I could not have done it. We really picked the right persons in some countries, which helped us accelerate the business.
Now, you mentioned something very interesting. You said sometimes too early, sometimes too late. Tell us a little bit about this, because there's often a very fine line between being too early or too late.
Yeah, we were one of the early companies in refurbishing IT equipment, and which is now hot. It's a trend, circular IT.
Sure.
Refurbishing. And we claimed that, let's say, that domain pretty early on, but it was too soon. We spent quite a lot of money on innovating our product, really having a top quality refurb product, where customers were not really interested in a top refurb product. So it actually costed us money and margin. But in the long run, it obviously helped us. That was one important example. We also Sometimes we were too early in a country, okay, where some countries didn't really care about circular IT.
Right.
So we opened an office and noticed that, you know, didn't really pay off. Those are, I think, two examples of being too early.
And when you chose that business, you said, I saw the potential. Did you see the potential in the context of a visionary projection in the future that circular economy would become more of an issue? Or was it more, hey, in the IT segment, there is a segment for this. So how much was the sustainability foresight part of this discussion?
Two-folded. On one hand, to be honest, the margins were like 60, 70% at those days. So
it was a good business.
It was a good business. It made a lot of sense. At the same time, cloud computing was coming up.
Okay.
And because of cloud computing, you don't need a lot of processing power anymore on your desk. So for me, tech-wise, it made sense to have a previous model where you can still work on that previous model.
Okay.
You didn't need the processing power. At the same time, we also understood that we're doing something good for the economy. You give a product a second life. If you can't give it a second life, you take the parts out, you sell the parts,
right,
you make money again. And then the last step was actually destroying the product, but using the raw substances. So we did do something back for society, but in all honesty, we saw that it was not potential.
Okay, so initially it was more of a good business opportunity, good margin, and also you're saying this kind of product will remain quite value creating for people because we will need less computing power. And then as time passes, maybe the environmental dimension picks up more importance in the in the discussion.
And in that sense, we were too early.
Okay.
So we were claiming that very early on that, you know, if you build a mobile phone, it takes 1,000 liters of clean water. If you use another phone, a secondhand phone, you don't need to use 1,000 liters of water. So we were working on those parts of our positioning, but most companies didn't really care about it at that time.
But nevertheless, at some point they started doing,
and
I guess this was part of your expansion. Now, at some point, you started exiting the business and selling parts of it. How did this come about, and how did you manage your changing role versus this company, which was, I don't want to say your baby, but which was, you know, really something that you had built?
Yeah, I sold it in three times. So in 2014, it was not really a sale. It was a management buyout, but we took considerable amount of money off the table as the founders and owners. And 16, we sold for the first time to private equity, which was a deliberate decision because we knew we needed to do acquisitions to be able to grow and to survive actually the competition, because the competition was getting more intense and we wanted to diversify into other markets. So there was a deliberate attempt to get someone on board to help us fund the business going forward. We sold last week part of the business, which is called CentralPoint, which is a value-added reseller arm of Infotech. That was obviously also one of the steps. And with all of those steps, my role changed. And it mostly changed in 2018 when I resigned as the CEO and I became a non-exec. And that obviously comes over time with I think sometimes emotions, especially if you've been an owner. And I did manage that, I think, quite okay. But you need to understand when you sell it and you move into another role that it doesn't come without emotions. It comes with emotions. And being able to deal with that is pretty important in that process.
And you manage that process consciously, you're saying?
Yeah, because I already had a plan, actually. I think some people sell their company without having another plan. When I sold it, and I sold it, you know, with an idea behind it to get a private equity firm on board, I already had a plan of changing my role as well, moving into a non-executive role, starting up my iron asset management firm and investing in other companies. So I had a plan, which can keep you occupied doing other stuff.
Right.
But you can also sit at home and only, you know, be a board member of your own company. Then I think it can be a little bit more challenging if someone takes over your previous role.
Now, let me go back further in your career. You started off as an officer trainee in the Royal Dutch Marine Corps.
Yeah.
How important was that in your career and in your life? Are there some key insights or some key lessons that you got from this formative part of your career?
Yeah, it did form me quite a lot, actually. So it helps you to be disciplined, structured. They put you under quite a lot of pressure. So you get used to being in a VUCA world, staying calm, grounded, balanced, sometimes making quick decisions and sometimes taking in a little bit more time to make decisions. You also learn to delegate because people have sometimes the idea that a lieutenant or a captain, you know, he tells you to go right, everyone goes right, but it doesn't work like that. You use the sergeants and the sergeant majors and the corporals, and you actually give them a lot of responsibility. You know where you're going to go to, but they tell you how to go there. And so it is all about delegating. So I think I learned at a pretty young age to get the team on board on a plan. You also learn that if, you know, you are, let's put it in this way, under fire, there's a lot of stress in your company, that if someone needs to call the shots, then it's actually you calling the shots. Because you cannot do that with everyone at the same time. And I've been always very clear about we do things together, but if we don't agree, then it's up to me to make the decision, and I want you all to be on board. Those are, I think, some of the things I took with me from those first 2 years.
Now, one of the other continuous threads in your life and career is the importance of sports and physical fitness. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's maybe also part of the military background, where they teach you to be fit, both physically and mentally. And sports helps a lot with that. You also learn to deal with losses in sports, because you cannot win everything. You need to. You also learn to you know, use your team to win games, or to eat clean and keep your head clear. So nowadays, for me, it's very important to stay active. I know that you need to take your time to sleep and to recuperate. Right. I try to eat very clean. And especially to keep a clear mind.
Now, let me ask you a few questions about your entrepreneurial career, if I may. First, you're a serial entrepreneur and executive with many interests. In your opinion, what are the key attributes of a successful entrepreneur? What does it take to be a successful entrepreneur?
Yeah, first, I think the question is what the definition of success is.
Okay.
And I think everyone determines success themselves. So there are a lot of entrepreneurs out there, and in their way, they are successful. It's not my definition of success, but
so I think, you don't have to be a billion-dollar company to be a successful entrepreneur.
No, you could have a small company with 10 employees. You make a decent living. You have fun. You can put food on the table for 10 other employees, and that's it. And that's their success. I do think that you can also ask the question a little bit different. What are a lot of entrepreneurs not? I do think that a lot of entrepreneurs are not the best leaders. They're not the best managers. Sometimes they're not the best communicators. They went into this business sometimes also because it, you know, it passes on from father to son, or from mother to daughter, or from mother to son. But what I do think is very important if you want to build a bigger business is, first of all, you need to really understand yourself very well, understand what you're good at and not good at, and then surround yourself with people who fill those gaps. I think it's very important to constantly educate yourself, to make steps. Most entrepreneurs are also good at having a vision where the world is going, but then you need to execute it, otherwise you stay hanging in vision. And what I said earlier on, it's super important to get the funding in. And some get stuck because they don't understand how the funding or the financing world works, which is something I figured out pretty early on. How can I finance my business? How can I grow it? What kind of ways are there to do it? It's also, and it's part of education, but it's also part networking and experience. And I've done that now quite a lot of times. And I've seen with other entrepreneurs that that's the reason why they get stuck.
So it sounds like you're making a clear difference between, in a way, we could call the startup phase and then the scale-up phase.
Yeah, that's where I think I'm at least a little bit different, but there are more people like me, obviously. because I came from a corporate background. I came from the military, I came from a corporate background. I did start a few small companies, but I learned that that was not for me.
Okay.
So I'm definitely not the startup guy.
So you're more a scaling up guy than a startup guy.
Yeah, so I'm more the person who comes in and then helps the entrepreneur, you know, in a mid-sized company to really fast forward, if I think that we can fast forward it, and I think that I can add value. And going through these growing phases and growing pains is something I've experienced several times. Also, you know, changing your own role and with the growing pains, which come with changing your own role. And that's where I think, that's where I think I can add value, which is a completely different thing than starting a business.
What do you look for to determine this is a business that I think we can grow, we can scale?
Yeah, there's a few things I look for. Obviously, we have a sheet with, you know, things you need to tick the box in. But most important for me is I try to figure out, can I or we and my team add value? If I can't add value, I'm not going to invest.
Okay.
Then the second thing is, okay, I can add value, but does he or she let me add value? And some entrepreneurs won't let you for whatever reason.
Right.
Because they say they want you in, but they want your money, but they don't want your added value. And my added value or our added value is mostly on the commercial side, having a vision where the market is going through, helping with marketing and sales, business development and funding. I always need people to do the operations. And that's where I think, you know, investment firms differ a lot, but it starts with where do we add value? And I focus on health, fitness, wellness, and sports, IT and telecom, and everything around human capital, which is also education or gamification of learning, because I do think that I have experience there and I can add value there. We look at certain sizes. It needs to be from 1 to 5 million EBITDA. It needs to be at a certain growth phase. There needs to be, let's say, a somewhat mature management team. But again, the most important thing is if I can't add value, I'm not in.
So we often say that strategy is about where do we play and how do we win? And it sounds like you have a very clear sense of where you ought to play and how you win.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you've worked with private equity firms over the years. Private equity firms are often criticized for being overly short-term driven, gutting businesses. Yet, interestingly, when you brought one of the PE firms, you said we wanted to expand. So tell us about your experience of PE firms and what makes a great PE firm.
Yeah, I've experienced many PE firms, sometimes only in the early phase, sometimes in case of Infotech for quite some time, which has been, in my view or our view, successful, that corporation. But they come at different forms and sizes, and which is something if you choose to sell your company or to a private equity firm, you nearly need to understand where are they coming from, what is their culture, where do they add value. As an example, some are very consulting driven, ex-McKinsey, ex-Bain. For me, that would have been great because I like research, I like statistics, I like facts. So I'm not, again, maybe not the typical entrepreneur. Some entrepreneurs don't really like that. They do a lot of things on gut feeling.
Right.
So if you then sell your company to a PE firm who wants to bring that in, might become very challenging. Some are typical with a banking background, so it's all about financing. Great if you need that, because if you haven't figured that out, that would be super interesting. And some are very good at M&A. So if you want to do M&A and you don't have that experience, it might be smart to sell it to a private equity firm which has done that a lot. That I think is very important. What is also very important is the people. So it's not about that firm, it's about the team who's on your company. And if that team changes over time or that partner goes away, you start all over again. That's where I think it's very tricky. And they have different statistics or let's say KPIs themselves. We should not forget that. They want to make a certain IRR, they want to make a certain money multiple. And for me as an investor, I'm not always looking at a certain money multiple or an IRR. Actually, I'm not at all. Obviously, I would like to make a profit or a return, but I'm more about when it's the great time to jump ship or jump train. And that could be where your money multiple is only 2, could be where it's 2.5, But it's, for me, it's more important, this is the time we need to jump now. We need to sell now, because that train is only going to come by maybe once or twice.
But when you say it's time to jump now, I hopefully it doesn't mean because I can see that this train is about to derail. Sometimes it could be, yeah. But other times is it we're no longer the right owner for this? Or how do you make that decision?
No, it could be derailing, obviously. Okay. But then it should be, you know, we need to sell because they're going to help us to make the next step. And when we sold to the private equity firm Altor in 2016, I had the clear idea that I wanted to do M&A and I wanted to buy two specific companies, which was Central Point and Scholte Aanwater. And I could not get my other partners to invest in it. So I needed the private equity firm who was going to buy into my strategy plan and actually help me finance that business, which we did. And then, you know, the business
doubled. So you wanted to jump on another S-curve,
yeah.
And you needed them. Now, Jordi, over the years, you have often pursued several projects simultaneously, which clearly suggests that at any point in time, you were doing more than one full-time job. What are the secrets, if any, to your productivity or to your efficiency?
Yeah, specifically around productivity, I don't travel a lot. I do travel, but I try to get everyone into my office. If we go somewhere, I don't drive. I've not been doing that for a long time, so I can work. I was doing virtual business, so let's say online business, already in 99, where you had still your modem and I was already working on my email at that time. So virtually working for me is not an issue. Again, there it's all about the team as well. Surround yourself with people who can do things smarter and faster than you. Delegate. You need to trust the team. It's also sometimes just simple hard work, you know, putting in the extra hours, to be honest.
Right.
But I've learned along the way that there's a lot of ways to become more efficient.
Now, we've talked a lot about success until now. Failure on occasion, is inevitable, but also can be a springboard to success. Would you be willing to share with us one of your failures, if any, and what you got out of it?
Some failures. I mean, I lost business partners along the way, which is not always, it's never fun, actually. So sometimes you look back and you think maybe we could have done it differently. Maintaining the culture is one of the, I'm not going to call it bigger failures, but one of the things I struggled with after we did a few acquisitions, because then the culture changes.
Right.
Reinventing then your management team and trying to maintain the culture you think you need to be successful. And I've learned myself then to develop myself, let things go, learn from the past, live in the day and look to the future. But it's an ongoing journey of reinventing yourself and learning. But maintaining culture, especially in a scale-up,
right. It's
pretty difficult. But yeah, we've been there. So sometimes successful and sometimes less successful.
Jordi, at this stage of your career, you've been successful on many fronts, including, I think, on the financial front. What drives you today? You could probably be somewhere in, you know, in some exotic place sailing. Why are you showing up for work every day?
I would like to learn and still develop myself. That's one. I really like to add value, which is the reason why I invest. It's not a financial reason, because if I get 3-4% on, you know, what I kind of have, then I'm happy as well. So I really get a thrill when I see someone developing him or herself, making steps. There's been a lot of people now financially well off because of the sale of one of the companies we just sold, which I like as well, because now they're able to do other stuff. And I like to touch as many lives as possible and giving people or children or people other opportunities, which they normally would have probably not gotten, which is also the driver behind the charity I started,
right.
IT for Kids.
In fact, I wanted to ask you, because you're also involved in a number of not-for-profit activities, but I think IT for Kids is particularly dear to your heart, in part because you started it and you're continuing to develop it. So,
yeah.
So tell us a little bit about it and also, again, tell us your passion for it.
Yeah, it was There was a news article where I read that there were 400,000 kids not being able to do sports in the Netherlands, which is just a first world economy. That was one. I did my first deal in 2014 where I took quite a lot of money off the table and I thought, whoa, what am I going to do with this money? And then when I looked backwards, I realized that my parents took two jobs in the normal day and in the evening so I could do sports and I could go study and I could buy those, you know, soccer shoes. And then I realized that there were a few kids in that time who suddenly disappeared because their shoes were, you know, torn down. But when I was young, I didn't realize that. So those three things came together and that was the start for IT for Kids. And I really realized also with the people I work with in some of my other companies that some kids, you know, they're 2, 3, 4 steps behind because they grow up in a different area or because their parents are not educated or because they come from a different background, speak another language and just came to the Netherlands. And giving these people opportunities is, that makes my heart tick. And that's what I really like to do. And the charity does this specifically for kids with sports. So it's kids with, I call it they're 2, 3 steps behind. Could be financially, it could be because they're, you know, have a handicap, a disability, could be anything, but that's what we try to do.
Jordi, last question. And this is the question not from the president of IMD, but from the leadership professor. Let's assume you and I started together in the Marine Corps a little bit less than 30 years ago. Yeah. And somehow we lose touch with one another. And so I stumbled onto you, Jordi Cole, 2021. What difference would I notice between Jordi 1993, and Jordi 2021?
I think as a young man, you think you know it all. So when you get older, you try to figure out, or you figure out that you don't know it all. Actually, you don't know a lot. Maybe you don't know anything. That's what I sometimes say. So I'm very intrigued now to learn and discover, okay, I'm saying this, but am I really right? So I think that is one of the big differences. Okay. The other thing is I probably got more calmer, more patient. If you're young, you want to have results quickly. My first three jobs were probably a year and then I wanted to have another job, you know, a bigger job. And nowadays I know that you need to be in a certain role a certain time to really add value. It's not going to help. You can do stuff in a year, but you know, you can do more stuff in 3 or 4 or 5 years in a company.
So is this something that where you're consciously making time for your own development?
Yeah.
Happens? Because some leaders say, I don't do this consciously, it just happens.
It's both. So I always say, or my wife would say, I'm pretty occupied in my head. So I'm always thinking and reflecting. And then I'm kind of off.
Yeah.
You're there, but you're not really there. And I do plan, I used to plan trips to Switzerland, now it's to Spain, where I sit in the garden. And I know while sitting there and reading a book, I get a lot of ideas and then you put the book away and you reflect. So I do that deliberately nowadays as well. But I've always been, I think, pretty, you know, occupied what I call in my head with looking backwards and thinking about what did I do wrong? How can I change this?
Jordi, it was a pleasure. Thank you for your candor. Thank you also for your insights. Thank you again for your time.
I think it was a pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Jordi Cole as much as I did. To hear more such interviews as soon as they come out, click subscribe or follow wherever you're listening to this. You can also find a range of forward-thinking analyses, business intelligence, and insights in our new magazine and content ecosystem called I by IMD. You will be able to register by clicking in the link that appears in the show notes of this episode. Thank you for listening and see you again soon.